Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Traditionally, the concept of sustainability largely referred to making enough money to keep a restaurant or any business in business. But in recent years, the term has expanded to include consideration for the environment used to source raw materials. This is especially true for restaurants that simply would not exist if the supply of meat, fish, and plant-based foods were not sustained. On this week's show, we hear from two chefs and a farmer who are doing their part to provide for customers while finding ways to live in harmony with the planet. We'll begin with a field trip to the French Quarter restaurant kitchen of G.W. Finn's to learn about Chef Michael Nelson's innovative work with dry aging fish. Yes, we're talking about aging fresh fish. And trust me, the results are delicious. Then we'll have a lively discussion with Will Harris, a pioneer in regenerative farming and author of A Bold Return to Caring, One Farm, Six Generations, and the Future of Food. Finally, we visit Chef Marcus Jacobs at Porgy's Seafood Market, where he's on a mission to introduce folks to the treasure trove of lesser-known fish species found right here in the Gulf of Mexico. So sit back and feel a little better about the future of the planet as we celebrate sustainability on this week's Louisiana Eats. Even the most high-minded chef knows that a restaurant can't be a friend to the environment if it can't sustain itself. After all, to stay in business, a restaurant must be profitable. Michael Nelson, executive chef of G.W. Finn's in New Orleans, put it best.
With sustainability ideas, if they don't make dollars, they don't make sense. And what we're doing does both.
What they're doing is innovative work dry aging fresh fish. At first, this concept may not sound very appetizing. You're sitting in this elegant upscale seafood restaurant, and the waiter asks if you would rather fresh fish or one that's been hanging around for 2 or 3 weeks. The choice seems obvious. But Chef Mike and the crew at G.W. Finn's have mastered the art of dry aging fish, a concept in some ways similar to aging beef. The result is an elevated dish, denser, more tender, and absolutely more flavorful. And G.W. Finn's customers can't get enough. Chef Mike explained the process while giving us a tour of his kitchen. Would you take me back to when you first learned about the aging process and how you learned it and who else in the country is doing what with this?
So the first time I really heard about dry aging were some guys in Australia that had been kind of experimenting and toying with the idea. But the Japanese have been doing something like this for centuries.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So even the best sushi guys know that fresh fish doesn't really have a flavor at all. And I kind of had realized this myself, is that if you butcher it too early, that the texture of the fish is kind of ruined. You actually have to allow a fish to rest, in my opinion, for at least 12 hours before you cut it, because the meat actually needs that time to relax. Now, when it comes to flavor, I think you actually, in my opinion, you need to wait 48 hours before you eat a fish. because there really is almost no flavor to an extremely, extremely fresh fish, in my opinion. That flavor actually needs to develop. So the best sushi guys have always known this. And what they have done is they would take the fish and wrap it in seaweed and kombu. And depending on the species, you know, 3 to 5 days. And then they would cut it into raw sushi, knowing that the raw flesh doesn't really have flavor when it's too fresh. Just like we were talking about with the dry aging, you need to allow these proteins to relax and break down a little bit. And those are where the flavors actually develop. So this is not a new idea. This has been something that people have known about for centuries. But what we've done is kind of taken it to a level of a very controlled environment where we can kind of take it a bit further. And so that's the general idea behind it. There's one guy in LA named Li Wei, who is from his restaurant called The Joint. He's kind of a pioneer, especially in the States. And when I first got started, he was nice enough to kind of help me out. And, you know, we're Instagram friends. And since then, he's come to the restaurant. We've gone on some chef trips together now. So we're good friends now. But, you know, he was nice enough to actually critique my stuff and you know, he'd answer my questions and he'd see pictures of me hanging things. Then he's like, are you sure you were hanging it that way? And he would ask me questions and he helped get me started. But, you know, creativity and this experimentation, it takes a lot of time. And I'll have to admit that COVID for me actually ended up being a blessing for this because, you know, buying these and acquiring these dry agers actually happened right as COVID got started. And it actually ended up being a blessing because it gave me an opportunity and time to really do experimentation.
So can we go back to the kitchen and see what you're up to here, Chef?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have some fun things back. Let's go check it out.
Let's go. Oh, my God. God, this case and what's coming out of it. Look at this piece of... Okay, so this is a...
Big eye tuna. That was caught in the Gulf of Mexico, along with pretty much everything in this cabinet right now. This one, I believe, it's been here just over 2 weeks. And that's typically the time frame I'm looking for is about 2 weeks. And you know, I can go up to 28 days in some of these fish. And what we're trying to do is kind of slowly remove the moisture from the meat. And that's going to go ahead and concentrate both the textures and the flavors. And then what's also happening in that time is that the proteins are breaking down a bit, which can make the connective tissues a little bit more tender. So we're going to make it more dense, yet more tender at the same time. Now, the really interesting thing that happens, and I think this is the part of the dry aging that I learned a lot about, is that when you do break down a protein, proteins are all going to be made up of amino acid chains. And amino acids are what we consider umami. So when you talk about all these umami flavors, these really rich, full background flavors that are really kind of chef secrets of making flavor, these are all flavors that are naturally within the tuna, but it takes this time to allow those proteins to break down in a way where these flavors are released. And so what I find with the tuna, it being a really red meat like beef, that those same umami qualities that are within beef are really allowed to present themselves and come out in these really rich flavors. So I think a way to get people to wrap their minds around this is even the beef you get in a grocery store is always going to be hung and aged for 3 weeks before they even grind it up into a burger, because the meat needs that time to rest and really allow those flavors to develop. And so we've known this about beef forever, that really fresh beef actually doesn't have much flavor at all. And so allowing the tuna to do the same in this correct environment really creates this new level of flavor that people are just going to be shocked when they taste it. I mean, it really reminds you of steak, because we're allowing those proteins to do the same thing we do with beef. We typically serve them bone in, and I try to mimic the idea of a chop or a ribeye, some kind of really dramatic bone-in cut on the plate. So when we actually present these to the guest, it looks just like a steak.
Walk me through maybe the differences in how you might cook them or treat them,
okay,
one from the other,
yeah,
or the flavor differences.
Yeah.
Give me the whole tour.
Sure.
bluefin, we age all the way up to 28 days sometimes. Mm-hmm. And the bluefin's much more fatty than a yellowfin or a big eye tuna. And to me, it eats just like a really great ribeye steak. You get both those lean and fatty parts in each cut. And to me, that one, if you really are a steak lover, this one will make you a believer in dry-aged fish. And then what we're also doing, if you see some of these other things hanging in here, when we get in all these really large animals, so that bluefin we got in was 416 pounds.
416 pounds. You know, I, just by my observation, I'm not sure how many cattle I have seen that eat, compare with that center bone of that bluefin tuna. I mean, that bone itself, the center, what would be the marrow bone in the cow, like it's about 3 inches wide, isn't it?
It is.
That's a huge bone.
Well, and we leave those large rib bones on there, and we actually serve it just like a tomahawk ribeye. So when you get the presentation on the plate, it is a truly dramatic, you know, amazing look to it. And people have never seen fish presented in such a way. But when we're getting all these large fish, we're breaking them down here in-house, of course. But we have to use part of it fresh. You know, we're still serving plenty of fresh fish also. But, you know, we as a chef and you know, a restaurant, we want to make sure we utilize everything. So when we're buying all this stuff off of a boat, and the boats don't land every day. It's actually the local boats are typically on the lunar cycle. So
really?
We get the majority of the fishing gets done around the full moon. So about 3 or 4 days after the full moon, all the boats are on their way back in, and that's when we're going to do the biggest amount of purchasing. So that's kind of when they get filled up the most. Now, there's a little sporadic things where we get you know, a few tunas and swordfish here and there, but the cycle is really with the lunar cycle. So about 2.5 weeks after the full moon is when our menu is going to be chock full of all the dry-aged goodies. But when we're butchering all these things to begin with, we want to make sure we use everything. So we've come up with a lot of new techniques where we do a lot of charcuterie.
And what did you coin that term?
I don't think I did, but I really think that it really applies to what we're doing, where we've just replaced fish with a lot of meat and in a very traditional recipes, and with shocking results on how well it's worked for us. So we have a muffalata on the menu right now, and so we have a mortadella that we made with swordfish. We call it sordadella. And then we also have some pepperoni, and you know, we make our own little bun here in house with the sesame seeds and everything, and olive salad. And I mean, if I did not tell you it was made from fish, you would never know. I mean, it is fantastic. Down here, we take the bellies of the swordfish. This is swordfish bacon.
We had a swordfish bacon.
Yeah,
never heard of that before.
Well, yeah, the belly flap of the swordfish is just as fatty as can be, and swordfish I consider kind of the pork of the sea. And we just smoke those, treated just like you would bacon. And we had a BLT on the menu last night. And then tonight, I have another giant bluefin coming out of Carolina that should be here this afternoon. And so we're going to be breaking that down. You know, there's some cuts that don't really work well for dry aging, nor do they work as well fresh right away. So we make bluefin burgers. So I'm going to have a bluefin cheeseburger with swordfish bacon on the menu tonight. You know, we're always trying to find ways to utilize every part of the fish.
Of course. And,
you know, we started off with our smaller fish, making our fin wings and our, you know, our little belly cuts and things like that. But this dry aging program's kind of evolved that into like a whole new echelon of types of food that we can make from the fish.
Okay, about the charcuterie process, you know, so explain how you get that flavor. What are you using for fat? And, you know, how are you escaping that trick of, I'll just mix a little pig in here and it'll all be great?
Well, we're very careful not to use any, you know, animal products outside of fish for this program. So even the casings are all going to be synthetic casings. But swordfish, I found, lends itself the best to this process. And swordfish, like I tell a lot of people, I feel like it's the pork of the sea. It's very fatty. The belly meat especially, like, we use it for bacon and other things. So in that mortadella recipe, we actually take the belly and we cube that up and we treat it just like you would the pork fat.
Really?
And so we make a traditional mortadella, but those chunks of of fat from the belly are those specks of white in the recipe. So when we cut it, you still looks just like a slice of mortadella. But what I think is really amazing about this charcuterie program is that the flavors and the textures are extremely reminiscent of their pork, you know, ancestors or however you want to look at it. But the fat is going to be reduced because, you know, nothing is as fatty as a pig. Yet, I feel like the flavors and the textures are still there. And so the fat that is still there from the swordfish, you're now replacing a really heavy saturated fat with pure omega-3s. And so you're taking something that you probably wanted to avoid in your diet a little bit because, you know, for a lot of health reasons. And now you're taking into something that instead of clogging your arteries, unclogs them.
It's incredible.
Some of this stuff that you might have been hesitant to enjoy for health reasons, now you have a reason to come try it here. So the muffalata, you know, our BLT or bacon cheeseburgers, all of a sudden you're taking those ingredients that were really unhealthy, and now you're kind of giving yourself an excuse to indulge. So I think it's pretty exciting, the possibilities. You know, we're still butchering every single fish here in-house like we always have. And it was a commitment we made many years ago where we'll never buy a filleted piece of fish. And all this really came from the idea that we wanted to know where our fish came from. And when you buy a fillet, there's really no story behind it. It's just a piece of meat. But when you get a whole fish, you can look it in the eye. You can open up the gills. You can see, you know, if it was cut along the belly, how long ago that was cut. So there's all this history and information you can get by seeing a whole fish. And so even if somebody told you where or how it was caught, by seeing the whole fish, it really tells the story. And so we now feel confident about how our fish was sourced, how it was caught, where it came from. And so doing that was where our original goal of only buying whole fish. But when we started it, immediately we realized there was so much waste involved. And really, restaurants and chefs aren't really aware of this because the fish houses do it for you, and for good reason. It's a lot of work. It takes up a lot of space. It's very messy. I see why people would never want to do it. But when you do realize how much waste is involved as a chef, and I know other chefs feel the same way, we don't like seeing things go underutilized or thrown away, especially a product that has this much effort and time and energy and these fishermen risking their lives at times to go get these products for us. Why wouldn't we want to use everything? And so from our perspective right away, we were like, wow, we got to do better. And so by buying the whole fish, it really made us realize that we needed to find ways to get everybody excited about eating more of it. And so that was my goal for many years, is how to use everything. And so even when we butcher the drum, the sheep head, the especially red snapper, we've taken our yields up as much as 40% per fish than any fish house that I know of can get. So in the case of red snapper, we have a 40% better yield as far as using the fins and the belly meat and the meat around the chin that we utilize off every single fish we cut, and we serve it on the menu, and people cannot get enough of it, that we feel like the stuff we've done for sustainability is so important, because people want to talk about this is a good fish or this is a bad fish as far as sustainability is concerned. But for us, we feel like until you're eating the whole fish, why are we even talking about good fish and bad fish? Because there's so much of it that people are not eating and not getting excited about that I feel like what we're doing here is really important, and that hopefully more restaurants and chefs will get behind the same idea.
Well, Chef Mike, I am so honored to have had this opportunity to finally come and investigate what you're up to in the kitchen at GW Finn's. Thank you.
Thank you, Poppy. We love having you here, and you know, you're always welcome at our table, so thank you.
That was Chef Michael Nelson of G.W. Finn's in New Orleans French Quarter. Next, Will Harris shares the story of his pioneering move to regenerative farming, a move that transformed his business, his life, and even his hometown. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Crystal Hot Sauce, always made with just three simple ingredients: aged red cayenne peppers, distilled white vinegar, and salt. Nothing artificial. Crystal Hot Sauce. Step out of the heat and into the flavor. From Rouse's Markets, synonymous with seafood, straight from Louisiana's waterways. Rouse's Markets tastes like home. And from Camellia Brand, beans done right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923. Camellia's latest innovation makes life easy for today's smaller households. Beans for two. If a bag of beans is too big for your family, Camellia's New Orleans-style red beans for two and Cajun-style white beans for two has everything needed for dinner in today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. Will Harris seemed destined to become a farmer. He grew up at White Oak Pastures, the Bluffton, Georgia cattle farm his great-grandfather established in 1866. At college, Will studied the industrial farming methods that had been used at White Oaks and throughout the industry since the end of World War II. Then, he returned home to become the fourth generation of his family to run the farm. But by the mid-1990s, Will was increasingly dissatisfied with the excess and waste of industrial farming. He looked to the past and decided to go back to a system much like his great-grandfather used more than a century earlier. In the process, Will Harris became a pioneer in regenerative farming. He recounts the journey in his book, A Bold Return to Givin' a Damn, One Farm, Six Generations, and the Future of Food. Oh, Will, welcome to Louisiana Eats, and thank you for making the time to talk with us. So tell us how you realized that the farm, in essence, was dying because of modern farming, and how you got into what you call regenerative farming.
I will. So my dad is the one that actually moved the business into the industrial model. He was born in 1920, took over the farm post-World War II, and it became an industrial cattle farm under his management. And I never wanted to do anything except run the farm industrially, just like my dad had done. And I went to the University of Georgia, majored in animal science, graduated in 1976, came home and further industrialized the farm that he had already industrialized. And I ran it like that for 20 years. And I enjoyed it, and I made money. I never lost money during that window, that 20-year window when I ran the farm industrially. We didn't make a hell of a lot of money, but we didn't lose any. And in the mid-90s, I had cause to really rethink things, and I've been rethinking it ever since. And I started moving away from the industrial model that my dad and I had been so fundamentally part of. And I'm still moving away from it.
So tell me how you did it. How long did it take and how you got to where you are today in that vein?
So I did, it was a fairly abrupt start, and I just didn't like it anymore. And I started giving up the tools, the technologies, the pesticides, the chemical fertilizers on the land, the growth hormones and ionosphores and subtherapeutic antibiotics on the animals, and just giving them up, which caused really serious production problems for a while, and we had to just figure them out. But we did, and we had some years that we weren't profitable anymore, but we regained profitability, and just very glad I did it. And I tell you that making those changes, while it was painful, ultimately turned out well for us. And probably the sweetest part of that is, two of my three daughters came back to the farm and brought their spouses, and that would not have happened had I stayed in that industrial model. I always loved, as a kid, loved the industrial model and wanted to be part of it, but my children would not have wanted to do that.
Tell me about those years when you're blowing and going in the grocery stores.
Well, I will, but I want to say that what happened with our business was so incredibly lucky for me. I mean, I would love to say that I was so smart and adept that I saw this coming and really made great changes to get ahead of it and be part of it, but that's not the way that happened. The way it happened is I became disgusted with what I was doing and started doing it differently. And coincidentally, thank you God, grass-fed beef became a bit of a thing, and we had it and others didn't. So we were able to sell Whole Foods Market and Publix Supermarket the first grass-fed beef that they marketed as American grass-fed beef. And it was just very fortunate, and I'm very grateful to have had that opportunity.
Well, one of the ways that you are making all this happen is your commitment to being as close to a zero waste farm as one can possibly be.
That is something that's very important to us. We had to gradually work our way to this point, but we're there now. But when we slaughter, let's just talk about cattle. We can have the same conversation about the other species. But we market, certainly meat is highly marketable. There are some bones that are marketable. The fat, we run into lard, which is highly marketable. Organ meats are marketable. But there is the eviscerate, the gut fill, there's just things that you can't sell for human consumption. And those things, and we generate about 9 tons a day of those bits and pieces. And we have a really large composting operation, and we compost it and then reapply it to our land. We compost it by mixing it with a carbon-based carbaceous material, peanut shells or wood chips, and we let it sit for a year, so it moves from being bacterial to fungal, and it is just like magic on the land. It's incredible what that does to the land. The organic matter in our soil has moved from 0.5% to 5%. 10x increase in the organic matter of the soil. And that is just so important.
Tell me about the greater White Oaks pasture today and all the various, how you basically saved the little town that you grew up in.
Bluffton, Georgia, again, is the town where I'm sitting in the middle of it now, in the courthouse, in the literally the one room courthouse that hadn't been operated as a courthouse for 100 years. But when we started, I had four or five minimum wage employees, and me and them brought our lunch every day, and it was fine. But now we've got 170 or so employees, and it's 12 miles to the nearest place to eat, and that's a fast food place. So we built a, or built a, we did, we built a restaurant and a store, and we have people come to see us. We have, I'm honored to say, we have a lot of people come to visit, so we built lodging for them, cabins, and just tried to make a little bit of a destination. It ain't Disney World. But it's but you can come and eat well and learn a lot and rest comfortably. And we invite people to do it. And we get a lot of visitors. We have a lot of people come.
And you're not really that far off the beaten track because you're just a little south of Atlanta.
Well, we might. It's 3 hours south of Atlanta. And
But well
anyway,
worth the trip.
I think I was worth the trip. A lot of people come, and but there's nothing here except agriculture. And there are not many places in this country you can be that far from an economy, but we are, and we're to some extent we're prospering, and we're prospering because we moved our business out of the linear industrial model. It depends on who you read, but it sounds like to me that the farmer gets about 15 cents out of every food dollar. There's a lot of variation in that, but that's probably about right. And here, we get 100 cents out of every dollar. And the business is profitable, but it's very marginally profitable. But so where that money goes is I have $100,000 payroll every Friday. $100,000 payroll in the poorest county in the country. Imagine how poor it would be without that. We're the largest private employer in the county. And I'm just, the fact that we don't make a lot of money here, it doesn't bother me much. We got to pay our bills, but it doesn't bother me much. I'm very proud of the fact that we have brought such wonderful people here, and the town is actually become a, it's become a nice place. This town, like many other rural economies, started deteriorating after World War II. That's just what happened. We can talk a long time about why, and I understand it, but that's what happened. And if there's not some redeeming value to the community, it just gets poorer and poorer until it's not there anymore. It's all ghost town. And here, a purely agrarian economy, as I mentioned to you earlier. But it's turned back into a very nice little town. When I started making these changes, there were two things important to me: animal welfare and managing the land well. And I never considered benefiting the town because the town had been in decline for decades before I was born. And I can remember one day I was showing somebody around and they said, "This is a nice little town." And I thought they were kidding. I was waiting for the punchline and there was no punchline. I said, "This is a nice little town. It's turned around." Happened so gradually I didn't notice it. But now it's one of the things I'm most proud of.
Well, it was such a pleasure to have this opportunity to have this conversation. I love that once upon a time you had a business card that said President of White Oak Pastures, and now your business card reads Land Steward and Herdsman. Thank you, Will. You are just an inspiration. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on today. It's a real pleasure, and you're a very gracious person. Thank you.
That was Will Harris, pioneering regenerative farmer and author of A Bold Return to Givin' a Damn, One Farm, Six Generations, and the Future of Food. Coming up next, we speak with Chef Marcus Jacobs of Porgy's Seafood Market in New Orleans. The shop's sustainability mission includes introducing folks to some of the Gulf of Mexico's lesser-known fish species. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, now doing for chicken what they've always done for fish. Fried chicken tenders, wings, sandwiches, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry has you covered with a mix specially for chicken. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. And from Visit the North Shore, discover world-class culinary flavors on the North Shore this summer. Experience the bounty of the bayou and rich culture from award-winning chefs, soulful mom-and-pop restaurants, extraordinary bakers, and creative mixologists. To learn more, request the Explore the North Shore Visitor Guide for inspirational stories, custom itineraries, and event information at visitthenorthshore.com. St. Tammany Parish, Louisiana's easy escape, just 40 minutes from New Orleans French Quarter. Walk into Porgy's Seafood Market and you'll find all the offerings you'd expect in the seafood wonderland that is New Orleans. Shrimp, oysters, crabs. But with a closer look, you'll discover fish even locals have never heard of. That's because of Porgy's mission: to showcase the grand diversity of the Gulf South with an emphasis on sustainable wild-caught seafood. Chef Marcus Jacobs and his staff accomplished this task by seeking out and working with multi-generational and independent fishers, bringing their catch from the boat straight to customers. Louisiana Eats visited Chef Marcus at his Mid-City shop and were treated to a tour of his remarkable selection.
My name is Marcus Jacobs of Porgy Seafood.
Marcus, I am thrilled to be here at the new Porgy's with you. My first question I got to ask you, how come it's called Porgy's? What's that about?
Yeah, so Porgy is an underutilized Gulf species that all of the founding partners here really love. And we were putting together the name for this place. We really wanted to have something that's representative of some of these like underutilized species, because part of our goal is to bring those to the public a little bit more. And we just said, hey, what's everybody's favorite fish? And unanimously, everybody said Porgy. So that's where we settled on that.
What is it and where do they come from?
So Porgy range all along the East Coast and then down to the Gulf, obviously. They're in the bream family. So if you've ever had like Japanese red snapper, they call Thai at a Japanese restaurant, it's the same fish. Really nice, almost silky, mild flavor to it, really fresh tasting. It's really versatile fish. It goes good in a soup or a stew. It's also good raw. It's great just pan sauteed. It's one that, you know, we started to become aware with through working directly with fishers and processing some of the bycatch they have. And that's just been one of the standout species that we get. And it's funny because, you know, it's the one that when we do have it here, it sells out. Like, we can't keep it around enough because people come in and they see the name and they're like, oh, I want to try that. Yeah.
Well, I'm all in. I can't wait for the next time. I don't see anything labeled that in the case, but why don't you take us through your case here and explain the provenance of everything we're looking at?
Yeah, we don't use any farmed seafood here. All of our fish is wild caught, and it's all either Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, just all wild Gulf stuff. Today we have a really lovely assortment. This is pretty representative of what we get in. It changes daily based on what's available. Today we have some American red snapper, really fresh out of off of Venice, comes in through Venice. Puppy drum, we get all that through Louisiana waters, really nice. We have some awesome flounder that's coming out of Diamond Head, Mississippi. The season there just started. Really just sweet, delicious fish. Yellowfin tuna that's also being landed in Venice. Awesome fish. We have some swordfish coming out of Louisiana waters. Buttery, super tasty. a little bit of red grouper and some pompano, and both of those are coming out of Florida.
There's more yummies. Tell us about the oysters. You know, I've been in a lot of seafood shops and stores, and I haven't seen a selection of oysters like this.
Yeah, we really pride ourselves in working with folks that pride themselves in their work. So our Louisiana reef harvested oysters, these are coming from the Tesvich family. It's their reef candy oysters. They're harvested in Burris, Area 3. These are all selected by the Tesviches and sorted out so that they're plump, briny, fat. I could chuck 100 of these oysters and 100 of them are perfect. It's amazing.
Mm. And what's next?
Next, these are Otter's Choice. These are coming out of Spring Creek, Florida. Florida has some really interesting aquaculture going on right now and really just nice high salt content, small, really tasty oysters. We feature a lot of oysters from our Grand Isle producers as well. Brightside being one of them, Southern Belle is another one, really love it.
Those are some monster boiled crabs.
Yes.
You know, they look to me like the elusive number ones that I have always been told get shipped out of here and go to Baltimore. Tell me about the provenance of these crabs, and am I right? Are these some of the biggest crabs you've seen in a while?
You are correct, yeah, and you're also correct about a lot of our nice crabs getting shipped up to Baltimore because they're willing to pay for them. These are number one crabs out of Lake Pontchartrain. We work with Pontchartrain Blue Crab and Slidell, and because they're packing meat there, they can really sort out the nice, heavy, large ones for restaurants and markets. So we get several times a week a few different boxes of number ones from them, and they're always awesome.
Wow. And then the shrimp. They're shrimp and they're shrimp and they're shrimp. What about these guys?
These are shrimp. These are 9-12 count jumbo shrimp coming off out of Grand Isle area. All of our shrimp are coming from Dino Pertweet. It is Dino Seafood. Been working with him in restaurants for the last decade or so here. He shrimps every day, every other day, brings us in really nice, fresh stuff.
Why, when people are thinking of shopping for seafood, when they're coming to a seafood store, what are the reasons that they should come here instead of maybe making a trip to Bucktown?
You know, I think that one thing is that we can really put a, particularly with the finfish, put a face and a family behind everything that comes out of this case. You know, I do think, and this maybe not necessarily with Bucktown, but I think there is a bit of either intentional or unintentional misrepresentation of where some seafood comes from that gets sold around town, particularly at the grocery stores. Yeah, I think people see certain species that are synonymous with Louisiana cooking and Gulf seafood and assume that they're wild caught and from here, and very oftentimes they're not. There's also just a level of rotating product and freshness that I don't think you're going to see anywhere else.
Tell me what your ultimate goal is here. I know you're trying to make a living, but what I know, what I know about you and your partners is you've actually got some loftier ambitions happening. Explain that to me.
I mean, really, a couple things that we really want to accomplish here are, you know, getting people more connected with where their food comes from, making sure that people understand that every piece of fish they buy that comes from a local fisher, that's money that's staying in their community, it's money that is developing their community out more, and it's money that's not going to some of these larger out-of-state companies that are really taking advantage of, you know, the size of their operation and undercutting some of these local fishermen. We really just want to provide access to good seafood for people. Like, I think it's really hard for folks that are cooking at home or on a budget to get exposure to a lot of these species, because mostly you just see them in restaurants, and not everybody has the time or the budget to go to a restaurant, you know? And we want to provide that same level of quality and access to people in their homes so that they can cook it for their families and try something different.
Tell us a little bit about what y'all are serving and why.
Yeah, we have a full lunch menu that's, you know, pretty much greatest hits of casual Louisiana seafood restaurants, po' boys, gumbo, We have a really excellent hot sausage po' boy that Vilcroissant sausage makes it for us. Super tasty. And you can also get anything out of the case served in a po' boy on a salad or as a plate with a couple sides. We also do boiled seafood, shrimp, crabs, crawfish. You know, we really want to just make sure that it keeps going back to accessibility for me, is that like people walk in here and it's, hey, I know I can get boiled crawfish, but I could also get exposed to this other fish that I might not have seen. And then the flip side is true too. People that come in here looking for, you know, they might want a half pound of yellowfin tuna to make sashimi at home, but then they're going to get a oyster po' boy and sit down and eat that too. You know, it's, we really kind of want to be able to appeal across the spectrum to a lot of different folks looking for a lot of different stuff.
And I understand that you're also doing some instruction, sort of. Like, people can come in here who really don't know what to do with some of these things. And so how does that conversation go?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, this is the first time that I've worked in like a customer or guest facing position since I was like 13 years old. So, you know, it's been an interesting process. But, you know, we get a lot of folks coming and asking a lot of questions, and everyone that works behind the counter here has a really strong background in cooking and butchery and all this stuff. So the conversations really happen organically, and I think it's something that's really special about this place, is that you can come in and maybe be a little bit intimidated by not wanting to mess something up or not knowing how it is, and we're gonna walk you through how to cut it, how to cook it, you know, flavor profiles, things to serve it with, and you know, I think that's really special.
That was Chef Marcus Jacobs of Porgy's Seafood Market, the New Orleans shop on a mission to showcase the grand diversity of Gulf seafood. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where over a decade of Louisiana Eats is available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and cooking class videos, too. And don't forget to rate us on your preferred podcast platform. We'd like to welcome our new major sponsor, Blue Plate Mayonnaise. When your poor boys, potato salads, and remoulade need that authentic New Orleans flavor, Blue Plate Mayo. That's the good stuff. And big thanks to our returning flagship sponsor, Dickie Brennan and Company. Happy Hour is back, Tuesday through Friday, 4 till 6 p.m. at the Black Duck Bar, upstairs at Dickie Brennan's Palace Cafe on Canal Street. With live music, a new oyster bar featuring crudo and other cold seafood selections, and as always, the largest rum selection in the South. Dickie Brennan's Palace Cafe serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner Tuesday through Sunday weekly with jazz brunch on weekends. Louisiana Eats is also made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Crystal Hot Sauce, Rouse's Markets, Visit the North Shore, and Camellia Beans, celebrating their innovative new product, Beans for Two. Camellia's new Red Beans for Two and White Beans for Two include everything needed to cook two authentically seasoned bowls of beans scaled for today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. And from D'Agostino Pasta, celebrating our culture with fleur-de-lis, crawfish, and alligator-shaped pastas. All handcrafted in Louisiana, just as it's been done in Sicily for centuries. Visit D'AgostinoPasta.com to learn more. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner, producers Blake Longlinet and Steve Himmelfarb, with writing contributions from Becky Retz, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.